August 29th was the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And last week, the radio program This American Life took a tour of the Ninth Ward. The Ninth, Lower Ninth, as they call it, is a predominantly African American neighborhood that was decimated by the storm. And for reasons which the residents really have little control, it also is taking the longest to recover. And one of the producers that did the interview, did an interview with a lady named Jean Gibson at a place called Mercedes Bar. And this interview was really the highlight of the show. There were 9 bars in the Lower Ninth Ward, and Mercedes is the only one that has reopened. There's still a lot of damage in the neighborhood. There are massive potholes everywhere that make it difficult just to drive through and to park. Most residents from the Lower Ninth never returned to New Orleans. But people like Jean Gibson are tough. The storm really broke them, as you're going to hear. They were put in unimaginable situations, but they have, by God's grace, found a way to put their lives back together. Let's listen to a segment of this podcast.
And stayed in a hotel for a while.
I was in one, but they put me out.
Why?
Because our money ran out.
Their credit card hit the limit. When she went to the ATM, she found out that her bank back in New Orleans was out. The ATMs couldn't connect. She was stuck in Texas with no money. So she did something she never thought she'd have to do.
And that was to beg. To sit on a curb with a 1- and a 2-year-old in Dallas with nowhere to go.
Right.
And I sit on the curb because they needed Pampers, they needed food. And I sit at that Kmart parking lot. And I sit on that curb and I begged every car that came out that parking lot.
The opening chapters of the book of Revelation, Jesus sends 7 messages to 7 churches. And the 6th message is to the church in Philadelphia, not Philadelphia, PA, but Philadelphia, the ancient city in what is now modern-day Turkey. Like New Orleans, Philadelphia was subject to devastating natural disasters. In fact, it was just years before Jesus' message that the whole city was leveled by an earthquake. And the church in that city was very small and impoverished. Christianity was not the dominant or popular religion. And from reasons that I'll explain in just a minute, the church was really under intense pressure to renounce their faith, but they didn't. They did not. They found a way to survive. And that's when I heard this story, when Nick and I listened to this podcast, the story of Jean Gibson couldn't help but remind us of these Christians in Philadelphia. What did Jesus say to this modest but resilient church? That's really the message for today. What did he say? Well, in a word, comfort. Comfort. Of all the messages to the 7 churches, Jesus' message to this church is uniquely positive and encouraging. First, he commends their stability. Then he promises them security and status, security and status that they have never known. And so let's just take a moment to go through these things. First, he commends their stability. Their stability. We see Jesus commend them for this in verses 8 and 9. He says, "You don't have much strength. I know that. You used what you had to keep my word. You didn't deny me when times were rough. And watch as I take those who call themselves true believers, but are nothing of the kind, pretenders whose true worship is in the club of Satan. Watch as I strip off their pretensions and they're forced to acknowledge it's you that I've loved." What's going on here? We need to acknowledge, you know, sometimes religion gets ugly. Sometimes religion is used as a weapon. And Christians have not been completely innocent in this regard in our 2,000-year history. But in this particular instance, the problem was a deep rift between the church and the Jewish community. On the one side, and it's important to know that the church was predominantly Jewish at this point and existed within the context of the local synagogue. The church was part of the synagogue. So on the one side, you have Christians saying that they're members of God's family by virtue of their relationship with Jesus. And that because of Jesus, ethnicity and religion were no longer the same thing. You could actually be a Christian without being Jewish. On the other hand, you have people who were still practicing Judaism, and they grew to resent and persecute the Christians, claiming that they were the real people of God, the true believers. And most scholars believe that some of the members of the persecuting Jewish community were probably former members of the church, but had renounced their faith under pressure. And if that's true, it would have made their antagonism towards the church that much more personal. So the Christians were under pressure, but they didn't fold. They kept Jesus' command to endure patiently and did not deny his name. And Jesus, he praises them for their stability. He says, "I know you don't have much strength. I know you're small. I know you're really not making much impact changing the world. But you've stayed faithful. And that has always been more important than success." So he commends their stability, and then he promises them security. And we see this in two different metaphors. First, the key and the door. Jesus is described in these opening verses as holding the key of David. He's placed before the Philadelphians an open door that no one can shut. What does that mean? What's he talking about? The key of David refers to a passage in Isaiah where a royal official is given the job of deciding who is allowed access to the king of Israel. And Jesus is applying that idea to himself by saying he holds the key of David. He's saying, "I'm the access point to God the Father and his heavenly kingdom. I get to decide who goes in, who is a member of the people of God." Have you ever had a door shut in your face? Have you ever been kicked out of a group? The Christians in Philadelphia had experienced that very thing. They had been expelled from the synagogue. And that meant for them that they were removed from community. They were not considered part of God's family. It was a very big deal. And Jesus says to them, "I know what they're saying to you, that you're not worthy of inheriting the promises of God. but they don't have the authority to say that. Jesus is saying, I have the authority, and I've placed before you an open door into the kingdom of God, and no one can shut that door. If you walk through it, he says later in the passage, if you hold on to what you have, I'll make each one of you a pillar in the sanctuary of God. Never again will you be forced to leave. Pillar. That's the second meaning that this metaphor carries. Permanence, stability. When you do a Google search, an image search for ancient ruins, here's what you see. You see pillars. Even when what they support falls, the pillars remain. And the Christians in Philadelphia knew this. I told you that their city had suffered a devastating earthquake. Citizens fled to the countryside, and virtually the only structures that were left intact when they returned were the pillars, the columns. Jesus is promising them that they will have a similar durable position of honor in his kingdom, in the new heavens and the new earth. They would be pillars. And you take these together, these metaphors, they suggest a dramatic reversal of their current state. They were experiencing rejection, and Jesus reminds them that they have been accepted and welcomed by God. They lived in fear and on the run, and Jesus assures them that their position is safe and secure, like pillars in a temple. That's Jesus' first promise to this frail, tiny church. They'll be secure. And the second promise involves status. Jesus will write three names upon them that will, and these names will bestow upon them privilege and honor. Verse 12, I'll make each conqueror a pillar in the sanctuary of my God, a permanent position of honor. Then I'll write names on you, the pillars, the name of my God, the name of God's city, the new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven, and my new name. First, the name of my God. You know, when a man became king in the ancient world, one of his first orders of business was to issue currency. And that currency always had his name, an image stamped on it. Coinage was a sign of kingship. And the king's name upon the coins was a sign that he was the owner of those coins. And Jesus promised to write God's name upon the Philadelphian Christians. They would be like God's coins. They would belong to him, not merely as subjects, but as children. The second name Jesus promises to write upon them is the name of God's city. You know, kings, they issued coinage, but in the Roman officials of that day, they signified citizenship by cities, identifying people by their cities of origin. Paul of Tarsus, Simon of Cyrene, Jesus of Nazareth. You were identified by your city. And if you belonged to the right kind of city, you had certain freedoms and privileges, and vice versa. If you belonged to the wrong kind of city, you were denied those freedoms and privileges. And Christians in Philadelphia will have the name of the New Jerusalem written upon them. They will be of God's city, belonging to it, and enjoying all its freedoms and privileges. And the final name to be etched upon them is Jesus' own new name. What does this new name refer to? Well, we don't really know. It's not totally clear. But it may signify the fuller understanding of Jesus that these Philadelphian Christians will have when he comes again. He says, I'm coming soon. Jesus promises in verse 11 that he is going to come, and when he does, they will see him in a new light. They will see him, and as John writes in his first epistle, they will be made like him when he comes. That's what's ultimately important. Not what the new name is, but the fact that they will share Jesus' name, his character. Their wills will become one with his will. Their hearts will love what he loves. They'll be like him. Now let's put all this together. To Christians who lacked family and protection, Jesus promised to write upon them the name of God. They will be children of God. To those without the privileges of citizenship, without the privilege of belonging, Jesus promised citizenship and belonging in the city of God. To those without hope, those whose lives were just wrought with despair, Jesus promised to make them like him, that they would be transformed into his image. So what can we take away from this passage, this message that Jesus gives to this ancient church in Philadelphia? Now, I think one takeaway is that Jesus has a different criteria of success than we do. His criteria is different. Think of the seven churches he speaks to in Revelation. This is the only church that receives no critique or criticism from Jesus. They are only praised. Well, if you took the seven churches that he speaks to in Revelation and you lined them up according to their size according to their impact in the world, Philadelphia would probably be last in every category. They were the smallest, they had the least amount of money, they probably were making the least amount of difference in the world around them. Yet out of all the churches, they are the ones that are uniquely praised and comforted. Why? Because faithfulness is more important than how we typically define success. Do you know Christ Church is larger than 95% of the churches in the United States? It's true. Just based on our attendance, Christ Church is larger than 95% of churches in the United States. We have a bigger budget. We talk all the time about wanting to have a positive impact on our city. And those are good things. But we need to not forget what ultimately matters. When we meet the Lord, his first question to us is not going to be, how big was your church? How much was your budget? I think his question will be something like this. Were you faithful? Did you believe even when it wasn't comfortable or easy? Faithfulness to Jesus is more important than how we define success. Perhaps another takeaway would be something like this. Jesus offers real hope to those who are poor and hurting. You know, one criticism of Christianity in the modern world is that it has actually been used in some circumstances, to keep the poor oppressed. That people have used it as a way to keep the poor oppressed because we just want the poor to focus on the rewards that they'll receive in heaven so they'll be satisfied with their miserable lives right now. Some people have used it. The critique is some people have used it to prevent social change. The opiate of the masses. Clearly, following Jesus, we read in the New Testament, following Jesus should lead us to work tirelessly to improve the lives of the poor now, right now, and not just hold them off with assurances of hope in the future. But that does not mean that Jesus' promise of a future hope, Jesus' promise of security and status is just rhetoric. No, Jesus actually means what he's saying. Jesus is a reliable source of hope for the future. He has opened a door for us into God's kingdom that is everlasting. He will write his name upon us, and the poor and hurting can find real hope in that promise. Let's listen to this other clip.
Driving into New Orleans early October. It was pitch black, no lights, just a few big military spotlights like a movie set. A movie set of a war zone. Soldiers everywhere, the hotels with the windows blown out, the streets coated in mud and white dirt, and so empty.
And I said, Lord, have mercy. Look at my city. And it hit me, yeah. It did hit me. But when I came across this canal, I knew there was no humanly way possible that this Ninth Ward could ever come back. The people that you knew, I don't see nobody that I know. People who know you, you know them, know your mama, know your daddy, know your brothers, know where you live, know y'all had a black dog one time. I'm talking about those people. I'm talking about people you did your first communion with and the people that would tell your mom if you did something wrong. You would never see them again. So, who am I? I don't know.
She didn't know who she was or where she was. Her sense of place and identity had been destroyed. Like Philadelphians returning to their city to just see it in ruins. And then on top of it, to just be harassed and persecuted for their faith. You know, it may not be on the same scale, but there are surely people in this room, and there are absolutely people in our city who are hurting in the same way, who hunger for hope, security, and status. And Jesus' promise to them is real. It's real. It's not just rhetoric. And my encouragement to you this morning is to take hold of it. Take hold of that promise and then be generous in giving it away to others who need it. That's the kind of life that we enter when we become followers of Jesus. That's the kind of life that we are about to baptize Anne Louise into this morning. So you want to come forward?